KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, teens and the world of the Internet, iPods and cell phones can be not only confusing but scary to parents. Anastasia Goodstein joins us to discuss what teens are really doing online, and we'll have an hour all about the youth culture in the digital age. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Anastasia Goodstein likes to see herself as the voice of reason for parents of teens or other adults who work with teens or just have teens in their lives. Unfortunately, there's a great deal of ignorance among adults about what teens or so-called N generation or Y generation kids do online and in the viral world of the Internet and other digital technologies. Anastasia Goodstein is the creator of the blog YPulse.com and the author of Totally Wired, What Teens and Tweens Are Really Doing Online, and she joins us for this hour. And welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as I read your book, I realized, you know, you can check browsers, you can get filters, which kids can get around very easily, as it turns out. None of this compares to just really establishing a trusting relationship with your kid. That's really the message that you're pushing, isn't it?
Definitely. I mean, there is no perfect technological solution. You know, if you're using filters, you're always going to block out, you know, some site that you actually needed. And, you know, I think for younger kids, you know, using technology to filter or to monitor is perfectly fine. But as soon as they're old enough, they can definitely find their way around it. And as you said, nothing really replaces engaging with them and talking with them about these issues. And I think, you know, because it has to do with technology and a lot of parents may not be as tech savvy, they feel somehow disempowered or like they can't do what parents do and really be parents with their kids because they just don't get how it works.
But kids can be furtive and sneaky and surreptitious and all that. And the fact of the matter is that sometimes they won't show profiles, they won't show sites, they don't want to talk about what they're doing. So then it gets into a real kind of ethical question of should the parent become more interventionist?
Right. And I think, you know, what I say to parents is with tweens or younger kids, it's really great to just start while they're at that young age and they're still kind of listening to you to really, you know, keep the computer in the family room, make it the family computer. If they're 14 and they're ready to be on MySpace or, you know, you're going to let them be on MySpace, that's when you sort of insist that they have to accept you as a friend so that you can periodically check in on their profile. And I think if you start when they're younger and really build that relationship and that communication around what they're doing online, it gets easier and you actually are building trust with them. So when they do hit 15, 16, and 17 and are asking for more privacy, you actually feel comfortable giving it to them. I think with older teens, you know, it is a little more challenging and hopefully you have enough of open communication happening in your relationship where you can kind of ask them, where do you go? Show me where you hang out. You know, I'd love to, I've heard about this MySpace thing or this Facebook thing. I'd love to sort of see how it works. Can you show me how to make a profile? And, you know, just kind of open up the dialogue and ask
lots of
questions.
Let your kid be your teacher.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really validating to them. It's really empowering.
It's also, you know, I was shocked to read in your book that MySpace actually has more hits on it than Google, which is really extraordinary. But you make the argument it's a public place. It's where kids hang out. So the parents ought to know where they're hanging out. If they're hanging out at the grocery store, they're hanging out at the mall. It's the same thing with MySpace. Tough to monitor, though, particularly when you're sometimes just not savvy technically about what you're doing, which is so often the case.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, MySpace sort of hit a tipping point this last year where suddenly everybody found out about it. I think in the beginning, in its early roots, you know, it was really a site for musicians in Los Angeles to promote their bands and connect with their fans. And then it just sort of, you know, hit this tipping point where suddenly everybody was on it and certainly every teen was on it. And the media found out about it. Teachers found out about it, parents found out about it, the authorities, and you started, you know, seeing these shows like Dateline and MSNBC to catch a predator, or, you know, all of these sort of negative headlines about what kids were doing that was inappropriate on MySpace. And I think that, you know, parents started to panic. They didn't really know what it is. They just knew that there was potentially this bad stuff happening. And it is a virtual hangout for teens. And just as you, you know, can't be with them every minute offline when they're at the mall or they're hanging out after school, you know, you can't be with them every minute online either, but you can definitely sort of check in and find out about what it is they are doing.
Well, there are those predators out there, and there is porn everywhere online, and parents want to be protective of their kids. In fact, at one point in your book, it said that 1 out of 5 kids are approached online by a sexual predator. And then later on, it said, well, the media culture exaggerates this. It kind of overplays it. The fear is exaggerated. And there may be only about 7% have actually had kind of contacts of this sort. So I guess the perspective here is, yes, these things can happen, but we don't need to blow them way out of proportion.
Definitely. And I think, you know, they are unfortunately getting blown way out of proportion. I think there's research now that basically says, you know, the kids who are actually engaging with predators, first of all, they're not little kids. And that was a big misperception. Second of all, they tend to be teens, and they tend to be teens who are at risk anyway, who are having issues at home or who have been victimized physically or sexually in some other way and are sort of responding to these guys and talking with them about sex or going to sexually oriented sites. So they're kids that are at risk. And then, you know, they go and they meet them, and sometimes they meet them several times even. And when the police finally do intervene, you even have teens who don't want to press charges. They're in love. You know, I think that's more, unfortunately, what happens with the predator issue than this notion that, you know, a predator is going to see a photo of your child that may have, you know, the logo of their high school and go to the high school and hunt them down and abduct them. I think that's the fear that's kind of been stirred up.
Oh, there's a lot of information that's shared on the internet by kids, and that's a fear that's real, though maybe overly stirred up.
The fear is real, but I think the reality of what might actually happen is just, you know, way overblown. I mean, there just haven't been that many incidents of that happening. And, you know, the abductions that do tend to happen are more often by someone in that child's family, an estranged spouse or family member. So, you know, I validate completely, you know, that's every parent's worst nightmare, but you just have to keep it in perspective and remember that with the media, if it bleeds, at least, and they're going to want to sort of, you know, cover the sensational stuff that's happening online, but it doesn't really give you necessarily the fullest or most accurate picture.
If you've just joined us, we're talking with Anastasia Goodstein, and she's the author of a new book called Totally Wired, What Teens and Tweens Are Really Doing Online. She's also a blogger and the blogger behind whypulse.com. Well, you do give some advice here, and I want to just make it palatable for our listeners who are concerned. One thing is, when you discover that your kid might be on an inappropriate site, don't overreact.
Yeah.
Makes an inappropriate posting, anything like that.
Right, right. I mean, I think that, you know, when kids tend to shut down with two sort of approaches. One is, if you ever, don't you dare, you know, and I think the other one is, you know, when you find something inappropriate, I mean, maybe it's the photo on MySpace of your 14-year-old posing sort of provocatively in her bikini, you know, or maybe it's in the browser history of your 13-year-old son that he's been to a porn site. I think if you sort of freak out on them, they're going to feel, A, you know, really ashamed. They're going to shut down. They're not going to want to communicate. And I think it actually is really a really good teachable moment and a really good opening to have a dialogue about, you know, about pornography, about what your views are on pornography, what your values are about that, and about, you know, objectification of women, about if you
might have already seen too much at that point, though, right?
I mean, right. Well, I mean, and to remember, too, you know, that some of these urges are kind of natural. I mean, I don't think that the girl in her bikini is posing for the creepy, you know, older predator. She's doing it for her friends, you know, sometimes not even the guy friends. You know, sometimes it's her girlfriends, just to leave those comments that say, oh, you look so cute, you look so skinny, you know, or whatever it is. It's seeking that validation. So I think it's a great opportunity to talk to them about those things and to talk to them about, you know, the risks of posting that kind of stuff. You know, we know now that employers Google potential employees. We know that college recruiters look at these profiles and look at what kids are posting online, and that it can really, you know, hurt them.
Come back
them.
To haunt them.
It can come back to haunt them.
Iniquities of their youth and all these wild things that they can do, and then suddenly it does kind of bite them in the... Also, you tell parents not to have or to leave off phones when going to bed. A lot of this talking is nocturnal and when kids are supposed to be in bed. And so just make sure that you monitor that as vigilantly as you can. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think what's happening now with text messaging is, you know, they can do it sort of at night under the covers. I mean, if you remember the sort of old, you know, the TV shows with the walkie-talkies where you're like, you know, on the walkie-talkie to your friend next door. You know, it's that same desire. It's really the desire that teens have to
I got them through bazooka bubblegum. You save enough. No, seriously, you save enough wrappers, you got walkie-talkies.
Exactly. And it's that desire, though, to just stay connected to your friends. I mean, teens are individuating from their parents. They're going through this phase where, you know, their friends are becoming more and more important, and they want to talk to them 24/7, and now they have the tools to do that. But I think if they know that you know, if they know you're going to look at the phone bill and you're going to see when the text messages were sent, or, you know, if they kind of know that you're on to them and it's a limit that you're setting, then I think that they'll respect it. More often than not, it's, you know, the parents who kind of don't know about this stuff or who are out of the loop that have teens in their rooms with their computers or their phones and the doors locked doing, you know.
But see, here's the central problem in many ways. I mean, especially for parents who... Well, you know, you've got the whole phenomenon, of course, of single parents, but also parents who are both working and who want to relax. And it's easier, you know, just like putting a little kid in front of the television set, it's easier to let the kid go to the screen and do whatever he or she is doing. And they become distanced in so many instances from their academics. They're always online. I mean, you know, I hear parents complaining about this constantly, or they're distanced from their families because they don't look up from their screens. And
right.
What to do about those phenomena.
Right. And, you know, somebody told me, I think it was a parent. I mean, parents obviously all have different approaches and styles. But one parent said, you know, I don't know when parents sort of lost the ability to say no or to set limits. But setting
just
limits.
Want to be your kid's friend.
Exactly. And maybe it's something with this generation of parents. It makes them feel young. They like a lot of the same stuff. But, you know, kids, even though they're going to roll your eyes at you, teens, and they're going to cringe and fight you when you tell them to turn it off, I mean, that's what parents do best is set those limits. And I think in the end, they will appreciate it. When I talk to teens, you know, they'll sort of, I can get them to admit to me that, you know, it's too much sometimes. It's information overload, and they don't know when to turn it off. And I think with all this multitasking, it's actually... They get that it's harder to concentrate. It is harder to concentrate. Just because they can do it and maybe their grades don't seem to suffer doesn't mean that they're not, you know, really able to retain the information the same way as if they actually turned off the instant messenger, minimized, you know, their 10 browsers and maybe turned off the TV and actually focused.
In many instances, also, they're not focused when they're driving. They're looking at their cell phone, or they're looking to text message or whatever, and looking at the screen rather than driving. I mean, there's a real kind of parental responsibility role here in terms of getting kids to recognize that these can be terrible diversions and that they can really be dangerous diversions. We're talking with Anastasia Goodstein, and again, her book is called Totally Wired, What Teens and Tweens Are Really Doing Online. What advice do you give parents about downloading music? I mean, they could be sued technically, right?
Yeah, I mean, they could be. The challenge with that is, you know, and it's the same when you were just talking about driving, is, you know, parents download music illegally, and parents are on their BlackBerry when they're driving. You know what I mean? It's like you can't expect your kids to, you know, to do this stuff if you're sort of not modeling it for them. I mean, and with the downloading issue, I don't know. I mean, you have to sort of look at what your views are on getting free music from the internet, and then talk to your kids if it's, you know, that you do it yourself. I mean, it's going to be tougher for you to sort of tell them that it's wrong if they know that. But, you know, in the book, I talked to some parents who worked in the software industry, and, you know, so they were able to really articulate an argument about why it hurts their business, you know, and explain it to their kids that way. And I also think with music, kids are, the number of illegal downloads is starting to drop slowly. I mean, they're still definitely doing it and burning CDs for each other. But I think that being able to buy single tracks on iTunes has really, you know, made a difference in terms of teens, you know, going and getting that song that they love versus having to spend, you know, $18 on a CD that they don't love the whole thing.
Now, Forum is on iTunes, and just to be a little self-serving here, we like to think this is a highly educational program. How do you get young people more involved in the educational benefits of the internet without sounding like you're hectoring them or, you know, trying to, you know, like parents can be go a little bit overboard saying read, 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 but there's extraordinary opportunities out there on the internet to read and to be educated. That's what it was supposed to be for, in fact, at first.
Right, definitely. And I think that parents have a big role, as do educators, in really helping young people navigate all of this information that's online. I mean, you know, young people are used to this sort of instant gratification in terms of, you know, if they're doing their homework, they're looking for something, they'll put that keyword in Google and boom, you know, they've got their top 10 search results. Of course, Wikipedia is one of them, and that's typically where they'll go and you know, rewrite a passage or maybe even copy and paste it because they're just so used to getting everything so instantly. And I think, too, you know, just in terms of being able to evaluate sources online and figure out which ones are really credible, who's funding them, who's behind them, you know, is this website something you should be using in a research paper? You know, I mean, Wikipedia, there's big debate over how accurate it really is.
Well, you remember the whole thing with Ted Kennedy. I mean, that scandal about just absolutely fraudulent and ridiculous information that was given about him by the Wikipedia contributor.
Right.
And it was done as a joke, but it was it was really awful. You know?
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of educators, you know, don't want Wikipedia used as a primary source cited in their paper. But, I mean, you could use that, again, as a teachable moment. And let's talk about what Wikipedia is and how it works and, you know, how people can change it. I have a librarian in the book that does an exercise where she has all the kids online. She has one of them change an entry, and they all hit refresh, and they see it change instantly. And then, oh, you know, they get how Wikipedia works, and they understand, okay, it might be a good place to start, but, you know, I need to maybe use some of the databases in the library to actually find, you know, research that my teachers are going to accept. So I think that parents and educators have a huge role to play as guides, you know. And again, you don't have to know HTML to be able to help them evaluate a website.
You got all those marketers out there, too, that make it more difficult for parents. I mean, there are a lot of landmines.
Definitely. And I, you know, my blog, Why Pulse, is actually about media and marketing to youth. And so I'm keenly aware of what marketers are doing to try to reach this audience. And I think, you know, parents really need to be aware of it as well and need to be able to talk to their teens about, okay, so the Square Burger, which is Wendy's, like, you know, hamburger mascot, you know, is on MySpace. If the Square Burger wants to be your friend on MySpace, you know, what does that mean? What is Wendy's ultimate goal? What are they offering you? You know, what are they trying to influence about your behavior? I mean, I think, you know, this generation of teens is so marketed to that they're actually pretty savvy about it. But, you know, I think building that media literacy and that marketing literacy about what, you know, these companies are doing, and especially when it's, you know, advert games or things that, you know, seem really fun and interactive and probably are, but there is another agenda, and just being able to really expose that agenda and have teens be aware of it.
Are we also getting an overplay from the media about all the hookups that go on online among teens? Because, I mean, some of the statistics that you have in your book are pretty alarming just in terms of sexuality in young people, just the numbers alone. But certainly the media plays up the kind of hooking up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's the minority for sure. But I think, you know, I mean, teens are very sexual. They're at that time in their life where they're figuring out their bodies. They're having all these urges and desires. And of course, they're going to express that. They express it when they talk on the phone to each other. They express it, you know, when they might hook up at a party. So they're going to express it online. You know, in terms of actually meeting, you know, another teen that they don't know and just, you know, hooking up for some sort of friends with benefits, I think that that's rare. I mean, I think that it does happen, but I think that it's rare. I mean, the reality is that, you know, teens are on these sites socializing with people that they know. Typically, they're friends from school or friends from summer camp that they're keeping in touch with, but it's a friend that they know offline. And, you know, I mean, they may be talking about sex and maybe flirting. It's a lot easier digitally to flirt with someone over IM than it is to do it face-to-face. So I think that the technology sort of allows for some more expression that you might not do.
It's also easier to flame someone than it is face-to-face. To flame someone. To,
oh, yeah.
And in fact, you go into a whole chapter about cyberbullying, and this
right.
is, I think, you know, you seem to suggest that, well, it's worse to be bullied on the schoolyard than, you know, on the internet. But some of these kids are really brutal to other kids.
Right.
And it's ugly stuff.
It is. I mean, you know, I think that there are some really severe cases of cyberbullying that happen where somebody is just so defamed that they literally, you know, have to withdraw from school or leave the school or transfer. But the majority of what happens is this sort of, you know, getting a flaming message or some sort of drama that happens. And kids, you know, they're pretty good at blocking, turning it off. You know, I hear kids all the time saying, yeah, I just ignored them, or I, you know, created a new account. I mean, the technology permits them to sort of, you know, figure out ways to basically ignore that person when it's happening. Whereas if someone's, you know, threatening you with a fist, it's a little bit harder to do that. At the same time, I think that, you know, the technology has sort of democratized bullying. So now the kid who was getting punched in the schoolyard can go online and wreak havoc on, you know, the schoolyard bully. So it gives everybody a way to sort of be mean. And the challenge is, you know, when you're not looking at someone's face, when you're doing something digitally, you can be meaner, you can be crueler. And, you know, there's the viral nature of the internet. So, you know, if you take that sort of picture of somebody doing something maybe they shouldn't be doing, they don't know it, you put it online, it just spreads, you know, to
put it on YouTube now too.
Put it on YouTube, exactly. And so because it's on YouTube, because it's on MySpace, it's public, the stakes are higher for this stuff. I mean, it's different than passing a note around school. You might get called into the principal's office, your parents get brought in. You know, if it is up on MySpace and it's a page that's basically devoted to humiliating another student and it travels all around your school and maybe to even some other schools, I mean, we're talking about a lawsuit in that case.
Also talking about the viral nature of the internet, and, you know, parents have to be mindful of the fact that if they're out of town, many of these parties take place, instant messages, kid might think it's going to be a small party, but it goes out like the town crier, I mean, in ways that parents can't even conceive, and suddenly you've got all kinds of kids that the kid didn't even know would showing up at parties. Happens all the time.
Right. I mean, that is the power of social networking and of having all those friends in your profile and being able to literally send out a bulletin to all of them at once. And, you know, the bad thing for teens and maybe the good thing for parents is that the cops are sort of keen to this happening.
They're reading MySpace now, aren't they?
They are. They're on MySpace. And I have talked to many, many teens who have heard of parties that were busted.
And we're talking again with Anastasia Goodstein. She is a blogger, and she's the author of a new book, Totally Wired, What Teens and Tweens Are Really Doing Online. And she's the blogger, behind WhyPulse.com. I'm going to open up phone lines. Lots of things that certainly probably concern many of you, and you may have questions or comments, and certainly are welcome to join us and do that now. Our toll-free number, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, is 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your calls, and you can call us now toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can send an email, and the email address here is forum@kqed.org. Remind you that you're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. Our guest this hour is Anastasia Goodstein, and she is the author of a book called Totally Wired, What Teens and Tweens Are Really Doing Online, and lots of advice here for parents or just for those who deal with teens and don't necessarily have a notion of what goes on in the youth culture with respect to the digital world. And you are welcome to join us. Again, our toll-free number for your calls from anywhere, 866-733-6786. If you have something you'd like to put in here or contribute to the discussion in the way of question or comment, we welcome your calls. We also welcome your emails, and you can contribute that way. Email address, forum@kqed.org. Before I go to calls and emails, a couple of kind of controversial, well, a lot of controversial areas here, but there are blogs, and there's so many blogs now with young people. I mean, it's just a staggering. But there are blogs now where, for example, kids are talking about bulimia to each other, or cutting to each other, or coming out. And in fact, there's a whole, as you suggest in your book, a lot of controversy about the whole nature of should you come out publicly in a blog and online and so forth. But these are all still areas that really need defining.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think what's interesting is, you know, that they're pro Anna or pro Mia is what they're called, blogs, and they're blog rings. So they're blogs that are all connected to each other. And they basically, you know, form these support groups, the same with self-harm for kids that are, you know, have these diseases that are really hurting, but, you know, are sort of there supporting each other in their disease to sort of keep, you know, purging or to not eat. And so in that way, they are really destructive, and they're sort of, you know, a magnification of what happens in real life. Because I interviewed a psychologist, Dr. Mike Riera, in the book, who told me that, you know, at these eating disorder support groups, you'll very often have girls that will, during the bathroom break, you know, walk off together and share tips on how to continue in their eating disorder. And it is controversial. Some sites, I believe Yahoo opted to remove those sites from their service, but other websites like Zanga sort of consider it to be a free speech issue and let them be there. And, you know, even in the recovery community, I've heard, you know, that for therapists, they actually, by seeing these sites and going on them, they learn more about the disease and they learn what's going on in these kids' heads.
I think Mike Riera is now a principal, actually. We've known him for years. He's been on this program. Another big controversy really has to do with, you know, kids will be kids type of stuff, and some of them will say terrible things, even make threats. And now, especially in the wake of things like Virginia Tech, this can be exceedingly difficult in terms of just making the call as to what the right thing to do is. In some instances, you know, it's no different than there was a home ec teacher that you write about, in fact, here. The kids were making fun of her, just kind of ridiculing her, and they were kicked out of school. Again, the line here is getting very gray.
Right, right. And they were 13-year-olds, and they, you know, put up a MySpace page, and they made very sexual, you know, comments about this teacher, which is, you know, I mean, that's what 13-year-olds do, right? I mean, they're just learning about sex. They use all of this language and talk about sex probably inappropriately. But the difference is that it's public, and that's with all of this stuff, and that's the message that really has to be hammered home to teens is, you know, it's not just your three friends who are reading your blog if it's public on MySpace. And I think, you know, for a long time, especially when I first started writing the book, that was really the perception and still is with some teens. Like, even when they put stuff on YouTube, it's like, you know, they'll put up a video of a fight that happened at school where somebody's getting beat up, and they'll say, oh, well, I just put it up there for my couple of friends to see it. They don't understand the searchability of the internet. And especially when an adult or somebody in a position of authority finds it, they're like, what? You know, that's my private, you know,
well, they have these cell phones now. You know, you take a kid will use a cell phone and take shots of somebody, say, in a locker room in undress or semi-undress, and then it's out there for everybody.
Exactly. All the more reason that parents need to engage and really talk to teens about ethical use of technology.
Let's go to your calls. We begin, Rachel, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to call and ask, I wonder if MySpace and these social networking sites are contributing to hyper-sexualizing teens, or if they've always been that way. I have a 14-year-old sister, and I'm 23. I'm on MySpace. You know, I kind of keep track of her, and you know, that's how we talk, more on MySpace than the phone. But I see pictures of her friends that are 12, 13, 14 that are almost exposing themselves to, like you said, their 500 friends, some who they've maybe never met or don't know. And I wonder, is that is that how it's always been, or if this is contributing to it?
Well, I definitely think, you know, digital self-portraiture, well, now it's digital, right? I mean, I have a photo album of when I was a teen of our photo sessions of me and my 15-year-old friend where we switched outfits a number of times and pretended we were models and, you know, just took tons and tons of pictures of ourselves. You know, I think that the culture has just gotten so much more sexualized and sexual, especially for girls and especially for tween girls. I mean, even stuff like the Bratz, you know, these dolls with their belly shirts and, you know, everything is just more sexualized. And in some
Plus
ways,
the boys are seeing porn. The girls are seeing porn. I mean, it's so available. It's got to be affecting them.
Yeah. Well, even, I mean, you have Paris Hilton, you know, and Britney Spears and Lindsay, you know, you have your sort of celebutante role models for these girls. And it's a little bit like monkey see, monkey do. I think they're sort of emulating what they see as being, you know, desirable in the culture when they take those pictures and put them online. But again, I think it's more about that and getting validation from that than thinking about who might see it, thinking about, you know, the creepy men who might see it or, you know, the college recruiter who might see it.
And let me thank Rachel for her call. It turns out from what you were able to provide for us in your book that there really are different habits, though, between the sexes. That is that girls tend to do more social networking on MySpace and on these sites, and boys are, you describe it as interest-driven, so that there's a gender gap.
Right. And I mean, you see it just like there aren't really teen magazines for boys. I mean, girls are sort of more social, you know, they're more chatty. And while definitely boys are on these sites, especially to talk to girls, you know, they do tend to be more interest driven when it comes to cars, say, you know, like one of the kids that I interviewed in the book was all about his VW. That was his first car. And, you know, so he joined a VW group and was probably sharing photos and tips on how to fix the engine with, you know, probably strangers or other people who just were really into VWs. And same with, you know, video games, tips and tricks. I think boys really definitely are playing more video games as a whole. And so I think what you see is even in, you know, virtual worlds are sort of a big thing right now. And, you know, that's where you have an avatar, which is just a physical representation of yourself. And you can pick your hair and your skin and your clothes and hang out in this world like a second life and chat with other teens. But, you know, boys are used to playing these games where they're these fantastical characters and they're sort of on a quest or a mission or, you know, whether it's, you know, something.
So there's a gender divide as far as the avatars, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The boys are much more into having that, like, crazy battle axe that they can do, you know, a million things with, whereas girls are about having the latest, you know, couture virtual fashion to try on. So I think you see those, you know, offline behaviors and gender roles being expressed online. But I will say, I mean, the other thing about online is that you can really experiment with identity. And so, you know, I've talked to teens who've, you know, girls who have been boys, boys who have been girls, you know, in their avatars just to kind of see what the reaction would be and what it would feel like. And even kids of different races, you know, experimenting with, you know, having a persona online that, you know, a black girl being white or a white
girl
being black.
Well, this protean identity where you create a fictive self, a virtual self, as it were. James, let's get you on here. Good morning. Hi.
Good morning, Michael. Always a great show.
Thank you.
Hello, Anastasia.
Hi.
Hi. I'm a middle-aged returning student. I've got a disability, so I have to retrain myself to try to do something different. One thing that I've noticed now that I've been back in school for a couple years is when I go into the college library, you know, there are hundreds of computer terminals, and almost without fault, every one of them is looking at their MySpace page or doing something to their MySpace page. And I'd like your comment, but my feeling is that there's a, like a hyper-narcissism going on. You know, you've got this dichotomy of connectivity, but there's, to me, there seems to be a lack of, I don't know, a social connectedness in cause, in overall feeling of like nationhood and the things that are important. And this is just not with teens, because teens are going to do what they do, but even to early adulthood, which, you know, some people live their teens well into their 30s or 40s.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point, and there definitely have been studies that, you know, are showing that this generation is showing more signs of narcissism than past generations. Is it, you know, the parents? Is it the culture? It's probably a combination of those things. I think with teens, you know, spending so much time on MySpace, I mean, they're doing two things. They're socializing, which we talked about, that need to stay connected 24/7. So they are being social, even if it's maybe not necessarily about something with a higher purpose, but they're also decorating their pages. You know, this is a big thing. Teens are figuring out who they are. They're expressing themselves. We used to do it by, you know, writing on our jeans or decorating our lockers or putting all these pictures up on our room. They can do that now on their profiles. They can, you know, switch the layouts and put their favorite song lyrics and put videos up there that sort of say, this is who I am, at least for this week. And the other thing that's kind of interesting with, you know, I guess college students or young adults, as you were saying, you know, when Virginia Tech happened, Facebook just lit up, you know, all the Virginia Tech students on Facebook were just using it as a way to say what's happening, sharing information, news, you know, anything that they could get their hands on. But then you saw students from around the country sort of collectively on Facebook, you know, grieving and expressing their feelings about the incident or their outrage at the shooter or talking about, you know, gun control and debating the issues and really connecting with each other across campuses, across state lines.
I'm going to go to some of your emails. And by the way, you can email us forum@kqed.org or can join us by phone at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. That's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or by email forum@kqed.org. Here's Leah, who writes, I work at a school and worry about certain students who are glued to their computers. They have access to laptops and chatting with their cyber friends rather than seeking out in-person friends. I understand the appeal for students who feel this is their only option because they're socially awkward or left out by the mainstream of students at their school, but is this hindering them from developing important social skills and reaching out to others who they might not be noticing who are in their classes and available for in-person relationships? Is there a benefit of having in-person relationships over online ones?
Yeah, I mean, that is probably the question that I get asked the most whenever I speak to parents is, are they going to lose their social skills? And, you know, the reality is we're right in the middle of this shift, of this change right now. And I think that, you know, when you talk to teens, as I said earlier, I think they will tell you that it's kind of addictive. You know, they want to be using all this technology all the time, and they definitely do need someone to tell them.
I think it is actually addictive, not kind of addictive.
Yeah, I mean, so they need help in terms of when to turn it off and when it's appropriate, you know, to have that face-to-face conversation versus sending a text message. And, you know, teens will say that they sort of get that, you know, like, oh, if it's something really major or important, I'll pick up the phone and I'll call or I'll go talk to that person. You know, they know that, you know, breaking up with someone via text message is just kind of lame, even though some of the scared boyfriends will do that anyway, or girlfriends. But, you know, I think that we're really just in the middle of all this, and what the long-term effects are going to be, we don't know. But, you know, I think moderation is good. Helping them set limits is definitely good. And for those kids where, you know, they are really struggling, either painfully shy, maybe they have some sort of disability or physical deformity or whatever it is, you know, being able to get validation that they're not getting, you know, from high school, which can be really, really harsh for a lot of kids. Like, you kind of just try to survive it the best that you can. Like, if they, you know, find a community online of kids that are telling them they're great, maybe because of their writing or their photography or poems that they're posting, you know, I don't know that it's such a bad thing if that helps them sort of get through those years. I don't think that it's going to, you know, cripple them beyond that time.
There's another listener, Robert, who writes, Anastasia is on target about the need to create trusting relationships with teenagers. She's also right about how addicted kids get to the instant communication with their friends. One helpful strategy to let them know that there is life outside of their room and away from their computer is to send them to camp for a few weeks each summer where, gasp, they don't have access to a computer. Imagine, no email, no AIM, no MySpace for a whole month. Instead, there are soccer games, craft shop, and canoe trips. Makes for a much more balanced kid.
Yay, Robert. I was a huge summer camp person, so that email just warms my heart.
Well, here's one more. I don't know if this will, but this is from Keith, who says, we recently were asked by a friend to watch her preteen kids for a week due to a family emergency, and the cell phones complicated the command structure. We would make plans with or give some instructions to the kids, but then there's this whole back channel of communication throughout the day where someone needed to be picked up early, wanted to change something, they can't reach us, so they call grandma or just each other and revise things on their own. Maybe it's good for them to exercise judgment, but there was no such thing as a standing order. Anything could get redirected by almost anyone, even the two parents.
Yep, definitely having more devices, I think, can complicate things.
Well, we hope we won't complicate things with more calls, but let's go to New York City. Bill, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
I just graduated from college last year, and MySpace has, you know, gotten more and more popular each year. And I had a profile for about 5 minutes, but I quickly was disenchanted with it because, well, first of all, I thought nobody was really looking at it. And you earlier mentioned that it was a way to decorate oneself. But I really don't see it as that. And
what do you see it as, Bill?
I see it as more of a cult. I think that it really comes down to conformity. I don't think that there's really much decoration going on because everybody's on it to do basically the same thing. And it really erodes human communication to a point that I find very, very frightening. And it brings it down to one line of communication. Nobody, it's a substitute for face-to-face communication.
Well, you know, in terms of the decorating, it's definitely going on. I mean, there's literally, I mean, we're here in Silicon Valley, and there's a whole, you know, bunch of companies literally that have sprung up in the business world. They're referred to as the MySpace ecosystem. And these companies basically create widgets, whether they're quizzes or slideshows or, you know, videos that you could put on your MySpace profile or glitter text. I mean, there's a company called Rock You that you can go and basically put your name in some sort of blinking, like, glittery text to put on your MySpace profile. There are some of these companies were started by teens because they just, you know, MySpace always sort of let people monkey around in their code and their profiles. They were able to, you know, create their own, you know, look and feel on their profile. Now, for designers and people with sort of a very specific aesthetic sense, this was kind of horrifying because you'd go on and you see these teen profiles with like zebra prints and neon and blinking, and it was just like, ah, get me out of here. But teens do love it, and they spend hours decorating. And as for, you know, the cult aspect or the sort of, you know, it replacing the communication, I think the reality is that most teens have online and offline communication with their friends. Harris Interactive, which is a market research company, recently did a study where they asked teens to evaluate their friendships, those where they're just friends with kids offline and they don't have any digital interaction with them on these sites, and one where they sort of communicate in both ways. And the kids said, you know, that they felt the ones where they communicated both on MySpace or LiveJournal or whatever site it is and in person were more meaningful to them. So that in some way it sort of added another layer of depth or just another layer to that friendship that, you know, made it more meaningful than just their face-to-face friends.
Let me thank you, Bill, for your call. You write rather candidly about your own rebelliousness as a teenager, and there's a whole section about your diary and your mother going into your diary and all that sort of thing. But it makes an important point, and that is that rebellious teens or teens who have private thoughts that you would normally have put into a diary under key now make them public.
No, it's true. And I think, you know, for better or for worse, I mean, a lot of parents I talk to are like, I don't want to see their profile, you know, because they're almost afraid of what they might find. But, you know, in some ways, those private thoughts that used to be under lock and key or the conversations that, you know, happened after school or, you know, at the mall or at the parking lot or wherever it was that you were hanging out are now happening online. So, you know, parents can actually have access to this whole other part of their teen's world. You know, some of it may shock them. Some of it may actually, I mean, I've heard especially moms of sons, you know, because teenage boys are sort of notoriously tight-lipped, you know, especially with their moms, and they'll, you know, sit in the car and just kind of, you know, not really say anything. But if you find their Zanga or their Facebook or their MySpace, you know, suddenly it's like you may know them in sort of a deeper and different way than just...
Yeah, maybe horrifying, too.
Maybe horrifying, maybe good. Maybe that you'll find their poetry and you'll be really impressed.
Yeah, but you know, I hear parents tell stories about reading profile. No, my kid was so into beer, you know, that sort of thing. Or anyway, let me go to more of your calls here. And we go to Jason. Hi.
Hi, guys. How you doing today?
Hey, thank
good.
You.
I just wanted to make a comment that, you know, you guys are talking about, you know, MySpace and teenagers. And I'm in my 20s, my late 20s, and I have a MySpace page. I also participated in online gaming for a while. Game called World of Warcraft, and I wanted to make my comments in the sense that it really took me until I was, you know, 25 years old to really understand the implications and the obsessiveness of these things, and it's only until now that I was that I've really been able to self-regulate these things. And you guys were making comments on how using MySpace and online forums should be supplemental, but it's hard as a teenager to not be addicted to these kinds of things and to be obsessed. And that's a real caution for me. Is I, you know, wonder what my younger peers are doing, and who's really regulating it. And I wanted to make a comment on Anastasia that I really do believe it is important to be involved as a parent in your child's activities. And
that's the major message from Anastasia, both here this morning and in her book. And thank you for the call, Jason. We are going to have to step away now. Those of you who are listening to us on Sirius will remain with us, but this is pledge time, and we hope you will eagerly avail yourself of that. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. On to more calls. Ben, good morning.
Good morning. I'm a student at UC Berkeley, and I am one of the few who have actually avoided getting a laptop. But I do notice a lot of times that laptops are used in classes to take notes, which I find a great thing. But the problem is when MySpace and other surfing and programs are being used during class. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to blame MySpace for any of this. I think it's a great program. But my friends and I are constantly being distracted by other laptops being used, and I've even seen one student who has not been listening, not taking notes, and all of a sudden a question was asked. He Wikipedia'd for the answer and raised his hand.
Yeah.
And, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I mean, I think that, you know, laptops in schools are definitely a big challenge right now. And, you know, I think that the desire to multitask and, you know,
or to play video poker while you're sitting in a lecture. I know, I'm serious.
That one
yeah, exactly. But even, I mean, I was just at a middle school where they have laptops for all of the girls in Mountain View. And I asked them, like, how do you deal with that? And they told me they're just absolutely vigilant about, you know, close your laptop, it's time to listen, or like walking through, you know, the desks. And, you know, obviously, it'd be weirder, I guess, for a professor to do that in college. But I think that, you know, in schools, in middle school and high school, where they have laptop programs, you just have to be that vigilant, or else it is just too easy to...
Remember, we were talking before about all the educational possibilities and resources that one can avail oneself of with a computer. But the fact of the matter is, most computers have been used for, are mostly computers, especially with young people, been used for video games and for porn.
Well, or in schools for PowerPoint and Word. I mean, I think, you know, I have a chapter in the book where I talk about education and technology and how basically, you know, this generation of young people is much more tech savvy than their teachers. You know, their teachers are sort of bogged down, especially in public schools, with just, you know, standards and teaching to the test, and they don't have time to figure out what Web 2.0 is and what all this stuff is. And, you know, but yet it's such a huge part of their students' out of school lives. And I think that there is a great deal of potential to use a lot of these sites and software for educational purposes. But often you just, you know, you have the hardware there, like you have laptops and you have software like PowerPoint. But beyond that, you know, teachers are just really struggling with it.
And I want to thank Ben for the call. Here's an email from Melina who says, I found that having a cell phone always on makes teens and young adults incapable of making decisions. They can always call someone, double check, get another opinion, and never have to think for themselves.
Yeah, that's a great point. And Sherry Turkle, who's a professor at MIT, writes a lot about the tethered generation. And she talks about that, you know, of being able to call your parents, you know, and ask them at every move, or if you get stuck, or, you know, you're out for your first time in the city trying to figure out where you are. It kind of hinders, you know, being able to really become independent.
You're much more dependent, potentially. That's right. Let's try to get you on, Jeff, on creativity. Hi.
Hi, thanks very much. I was listening to some of these other tools, and I was really frustrated because I'm not into glitter text, and I'm not really into thinking that that's the way that I want to express myself. So I was just telling that, you know, I've been using a new tool, and it's really been about how I can creatively express. And me and my friends have been really excited about sharing what we've been using together, and then we've built our own channels. And that's where I think a lot of this is going, is that, you know, I want to have my own channel out to the world, that I can feel like that these are my creations. And the tools just weren't there before, but there's a new thing that my friends and I have been using. So I just wanted to make the point that this is, it seems to be an era of, what I liked about this website, it was like, they said it was a visual voice, and that really resonated with me. It's a self-expression.
Well, thank you for the expression of that, Jeff. I appreciate your contribution here. Did you want to comment, Anastasia?
I think that we are just in an amazing time where everything is being sort of democratized in terms of the media, and there are so many tools. I'm sure the tool that you found, there are many more that I'm sure I don't even know about, where young people are creating their own media, creating their own podcasts, creating their own videos. Some of them may be, you know, kids running through fences and kind of that jackass-like ridiculousness, but some of them can be really, really good. I mean, there are a lot of talented teens out there who are making funny skits or, you know, have great radio programs. So I think it's great.
Well, it's a brave new world, and you've certainly helped us understand more of it. I thank you for being with us. Again, Anastasia Goodstein's book is called Totally Wired, What Teens and Tweens Are Really Doing Online, and she's behind the blogger whypulse.com. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. And I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory, with production assistance from Elsa Chang. Also, thank you, our listeners, because we wouldn't be here without you, and we do appreciate your listenership. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.